This is episode 355, dated Friday, April 12th, 2024.
You are listening to the In Perspective weekly podcast with Bob Branco and Peter O'Toole.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to In Perspective. My name is Bob Branco, and this is episode 355, dated Friday, April 12th, 2024. And by the way, I must make a correction. On last Friday, I told you that that was April the 7th. It was really April the 5th, so my apologies for that mistake. With us, of course, as always, our good friend and co-host, Peter O'Toole. Peter, how was Subway? You said that off the air. You had Subway today. What did you eat?
I had a foot-long tuna sandwich with cucumbers and cheese and lettuce and all kinds of good stuff. It was delicious.
All right. Okay. How's the weather in Coos Bay?
It is Coos Bay. It's sunny and rainy at the same time, but it's getting warmer. We will get to spring at some point around here.
Let's hope so. We're rainy and wind for most of today. It's improving as we speak, but still. We're anticipating spring-like conditions in the very near future. I want to thank those people who make it possible for In Perspective to be aired and to be made available. We start out with Raymond Gay, our producer. Thank you for what you do. Tom and Lynn from Rosie's Place Chatline. Thank you for posting our shows. Also, our media outlets. Thank you for airing us when you do. Jacqueline Sylvia from JS Web Solutions, thank you for archiving our shows on my website. To find the archives, go to www.brancoevents.com. Arrow down until you get to In Perspective Podcasts. Click on them, and you will find most of our archives from latest to earliest.
Merci, Jackie.
And may I say hi to Trish, our host. Thank you, Trish, once again for taking the time to be with us today. And for Brad for streaming on ACB Media 5. And because of that reason, let me give out my email address, which is bobbranco93@gmail.com. That's bobbranco93@gmail.com. For those of you who would like to send us your thoughts about In Perspective, we always welcome feedback from listeners. You are the driving force for our program. Please do not forget that. Today we are very pleased to have with us Linda McKinney Lambert. She's going to talk about her latest book entitled Every Day Brings Some Small Joy. Linda, it's always a joy to have you with us. Thanks for being here. Welcome.
Thank you, Bob. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, congratulations once again. Us authors must stick together. We all know what it's like. We do appreciate what you do, believe me.
I think we all appreciate each other. It's great to be among a fellowship of writers because we all share so much with each other.
We certainly do.
Mm-hmm.
So, Linda, what struck me about the book, first of all, mm-hmm. congratulations. It just came out.
Yes, thank you, Peter.
What struck me about the book, and lots of things did, but one of the things is there are various threads of your life that are sort of woven together throughout the book. And so I thought we'd talk about some of those threads and then talk about how they sort of come together in this book. So you are first a writer. So talk about sort of your prior writing experience.
Sure. I'd be glad to do that. I would say that I started writing around, my first thing I had published was in 1980, and I wasn't really a writer. I just wrote an article that was published in a magazine, a national magazine. I raised birds, and the magazine was a story I wrote about how I tamed a wild macaw that I had. And I sent pictures of me with the bird and everything and described how I found the bird and all that. And that was published. So that's the first thing I can remember ever having published or written. I did not start writing until mid-80s. What happened was I was working on my BFA degree at Slippery Rock University in Fine Arts. And So probably the last course I took before I got that degree was an intro to poetry course. And the other thing that, so that, and I don't remember that that was particularly a writing course, but I do think we did some writing as well as reading and learning to explicate the poetry. But I think that as a art major, you do intensive studies in art history. So that means you're writing, you're doing research and you're writing constantly. That's a huge part of having a fine arts degree. So I was writing, you know, through those years from 1985 when I first went to the university and till I left there when I graduated from that one in 89. Yeah. And so I was writing all the time because of the art history courses. And
what university, I'm sorry, Linda, what university was that, may I ask?
That was Slippery Rock, University of Pennsylvania. That's about an hour from where I live in Western Pennsylvania. It's one of the, I think, 16 state school systems here.
And you have written, as I understand, quite a few books of poetry over the years. Talk a little about that writing, then we'll move on to other things.
Yeah. I wrote my first book after I became a professor. It was when you begin to take the path to be a tenured professor, you have a certain amount of time that you have to begin to put together what you're going to do for your tenure project. So I was officially in the English department at Geneva College, and that's in Beaver Falls, which is about a half hour from where I live. And as part of my job there, I was the art history lecturer for the humanities department. And then I also did all the studio art courses. I was the one and only art professor at the school. So I wore three different hats all the time. So writing was just a part of everything I did in teaching but I wrote the first book after I was there at the school working on my tenure project. The year after I went there, I had discovered they didn't have a program that took students to Germany or Austria or Germanic studies. So I asked about putting together a program where I would take students in the summer for a month-long stay in Austria because I had connections there and I could make that all happen. And so a year after I started teaching there, my second year there, I was on my way in July for the first trip to Austria with students. And the course I taught there was called Drawing and Writing in Salzburg. And we stayed in a village. For the first couple of years, we stayed in Salzburg, and then we moved to an outlying village about 15 minutes out of Salzburg. And so I ended up being there for my whole career, doing that every summer until I retired. And some summers I even did it a couple times. But so I was taking students there. And so for my tenure project, that gave me material to work with for my tenure project. So I wrote a book based on my travels there. And as my course was part drawing and part writing, so I was writing all the time in my journals and writing poetry and just, you know, making notes about everything. So I just gathered all that stuff together and I created a book out of it. And that was called Concerti, Psalms for the Pilgrimage. And that was in 2001, I think. So that was my first book. I never intended to write another book. I did that for my tenure project, but I was so busy with my full schedule of teaching during the school semesters and then teaching in the summer that it never entered my mind to write another book. But after I lost my sight and then retired, and it took me quite a long time before I could use a computer again. And so as a way of communicating, I began a blog. That was in 2009. 2009. I began a blog. And after a while of writing the blog, it occurred to me I was writing all these stories. And I thought maybe I could start collecting these stories together and maybe I could write a book. And so that was 2017, that book came out. And that was called Walking by Inner Vision. And
I remember it.
Yeah. You know, I had a phone call today, an hour ago, from a woman who was reading that book, and she called to tell me how much one of the stories meant to her and how she had shared it with another person and how that person just opened up and wanted to talk about his own past and everything after reading that story. That's just, I mean, that's why I write, because I write for one person. I never knew who that one person's going to be, but it'll be a phone call like that, or it'll be a little message. It'll be somebody calling me. And that just means the world to me. That's really what keeps me writing. So that was then the second book. Then I went on to do a book of nothing but poetry called Star Signs. And that was done through the Dworkins. That was the first time. No. Yeah, that was done through the Dworkins. That was the first all poetry book. I also did a book with Finishing Line Press. It's a chapbook called First Snow, and it's wintry poems with wintry themes. And then I went back and revisited that first book because I did that for my tenure project. I had all these years in between to think about all the other things I would have wanted to do if I wasn't under a deadline to make the tenure project. So I went back and revisited that, and I added a ton more stuff to it. It's the whole book as it existed in the first place, but it's completely reconfigured and then like twice as much more material in it. And that was the book that came out 2 years ago, and that's called Songs for the Pilgrimage. So it's poetry, it's historical pieces from the different places where I would stay or where I would be in the summertime, and it's short stories. It's all nonfiction and poetry. Yeah, so that's where we are.
That's terrific. Thank you for that. And it really is true, isn't it? You know, we write, we're not quite sure who we're going to write for.
No.
But ultimately, we're going to write for something that we're happy with.
Yes.
Ultimately, but we have an audience. And who that audience is does influence how we write.
You know what? This exact conversation was in the phone call that I had right before this meeting here when that woman called me, because she asked me, she wanted to know about how I decide where the home is going to be for the things that my art or my writing. I said, can you take home out of this question? I said, I don't think of home. I don't think of placing them anywhere. I create them. And then one of my favorite art professors, who was a Buddhist, told me years ago, she was a mentor to me for many years, and she told me, Linda, don't ever worry about selling your work or where it's going to go. Your job is to make the work, and God's job will take it from there.
I agree.
And that's been my philosophy all these years.
So then I want to talk to you about, before we get into the book, there are two other, I think, really important threads through the book. One of them is your gardening.
Yes.
The book has to do with your, so talk about your love of gardening, and then talk about your sort of faith journey. There's a lot of references to any other things. So talk about that, and then we'll talk about the book.
I was trying to think a while ago about when I started writing the pieces about my gardens. And as with most things with me, they just kind of happen, and I don't really plan them. But next thing I know, I'm involved in something, and it's taking shape. Well, that's what happened with these little poems. I just started writing little garden poems. I called them garden songs for my blog, just to have a little thing on my blog that, you know, I would post every week, and I would post a little poem or two. So after I had done this for a while, I realized I've been doing this for like 3 years, I think. And someone had said to me, Linda, why aren't you writing about your gardens and about your flowers? And it's like, I hadn't even thought of it. So that's what, you know, encouraged me then. My cat just jumped up on the back of my chair. Oh. That's the noise.
We didn't hear it.
Okay. He hit my magnifying machine. So it made a loud crack. Ah, there we go. So that's how that all started, with someone saying to me, why don't you write about your flower beds? I started creating the flower beds several years ago. And again, I had a hillside that was just nasty looking and weedy and all that. And it depressed me to think about it, but it just seemed too overwhelming to ever do anything about it. And then I had the idea, well, just work for 1 hour and just see what you can do in 1 hour. And once I worked for an hour, then I'd work for another one and another one. And next thing I know, I created this wonderful garden the whole way down the property and on the hillside. And I have flowers everywhere now. And it's just over the last few years. I'm not a real gardener. You know, I'm not an expert at gardening, but I just began buying flowers and bulbs and things that I thought would make it pretty. And the most wonderful thing that happened to me the last 2 years, first of all, 2 years ago, I was standing out rurally in the morning and I was watering the flowers out front. And I live in the country. It's just a little country road. It's about 2 miles long. And a lady pulled up in a beautiful white truck, just like a really good looking white truck. And she put her window down and she said, are you the person that takes care of these gardens? And I just smiled and said, yes. I was up on the hillside and she was like down on the road looking up at me. She said, I just can't believe it. She said, to think I'm driving on this little country road heading toward the creek and there is all these beautiful flowers everywhere. She said, this is just amazing. So off she went and it was like, oh my goodness, how nice. And then last summer it happened 2 more times. I'm out there working and again, it was 2 different times and each one of them was driving a beautiful white truck and each one of them pulled it. One said, oh, your yard is so beautiful. And the other one said, I just love to look at your house. Oh, everything's so pretty. So, you know, to me, that just meant everything. And so when I'm out there working, I think about bringing beauty to an unexpected little place that maybe nobody would even notice in the wood, you know, along the woods or by the creek there. And I plant the flowers because I believe that somebody will go by and look at them and it'll just lift up their spirits and make them feel good about something, you know, as they go by. So,
now talk about how that connects with your faith.
Well, that, you know, that's another interesting connection that I began to realize just recently. And so I was trying to think, as I said, when did I start concentrating on writing this book and working with the flowers and everything? And I have to go back to 1973 for that, because I am a person of faith. I was born again when I was 15 years old. And there's a whole great story behind that that is just utterly miraculous about what happened to me one night when I was out running around with girlfriends. But so that was when I was 15. But when I was 30 years old, we had visitors that came to our house for 3 days. They were missionaries from Vietnam. And our son, who's on the call here, is from Vietnam. So they had come by because they were taking a tour of the United States and visiting the children and the families where the children had come to live. So before they left in the morning, we had prayer outside by the camper. We made a circle. And then the lady, her name was Alta, she had a book in her hands and she said to me, I was reading this book this morning and I just really felt like this would be a book you would like to read. And so she put a little book into my hands. That book is called Come Away, My Beloved by Francis Roberts. And since 1973, on and off, I have been reading this book. It literally was falling apart. All the pages are unglued. So about a year ago, I decided to see if I could find the book on Amazon, and I did. There's like a whole different, it's been reproduced and everything. So I read from that book every day. It's called Come Away, My Beloved. But when she gave me that book, I began to read it, and I just began to weep. I just felt so much love. And I didn't know why, but that book led me to really dedicate myself to the Lord and to following Jesus and his path for my life. And that book means every bit as much to me today as it did back in 1973. I read something every day from it before I read the Bible. And every day, it's like the Holy Spirit shines a flashlight on it and says, look at this. You didn't see this before. And it'll be something that I don't even remember reading.
So as I recall, that reference, that title, is from the Song of Solomon. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, because there's a lushness in that Bible book, right? That it comes through in your book and this current book. Can you talk about that? There's a sort of is there a connection between the Song of Solomon and this book in particular, you think?
I think there is, because of the love. When you read that Song of Solomon, it's all about love. It's just, you know, the whole thing is about love and about life and living life to the fullest and enjoying nature. You know, talks about, you know, being out in the fields and the flowers. And so, yeah, there's definitely a connection there. That's why I ended the book with that quote from Song of Solomon.
Yeah, I saw that. I thought that was interesting. Yeah. So let's talk about this new book. And really the way I view this book, is sort of these sort of strands of your life, especially the gardening piece.
Yeah.
With your love of arts in general and your writing and of your faith come together in sort of sometimes in really unexpected ways.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the title first. Each day holds some small joy. Why that?
That is from Francis Roberts' book, Come Away, My Beloved. I took a couple sentences or so out of one of the little short meditations, and that exact line is in there. I think that I have that in the preface of the book. I think I opened the preface with that quote. I know I identify it sort of at the beginning of the book. And that's the other thing. I was writing all these things and thinking I would do a book. I went through a dozen different ideas of what the book should be called. And I just kept nothing would work. I would call it one thing, but I would say what I was doing, but then, you know, then that wouldn't work. And nothing felt right until I read that one meditation. And I saw those few words and I said, that's it. That's the name of my book. It's about little small things.
And they really are about your poems are about little small things. And the poems themselves are pretty short, right? I mean,
yes.
And so talk about, and the lines are pretty short too. I don't remember seeing too many lines more than, I'm making this number up, but more than say 10 syllables. I think.
You're probably right.
Everything is in miniature. What's that? I'm sorry.
Yes. Yes. As I said, I've had a lot of influence in Japanese culture because of my former professor, Akiko Katani. So I have a reverence for space that you find in Japanese art and writing and really in Japanese aesthetics, that space is as valuable as the things in that space. That, like, I wanted to create this book in that way so that I had in my mind going through this book like you would enter into an art gallery. The walls in an art gallery are usually white unless it's a special show. So you go in and you're in this white space and you just walk in there till you come to a wall. And then let's say there's a painting there. You stop and you look at the painting. Now, I can't really see paintings anymore, so I'm just envisioning this the way it would be when I could do that. But so you stop and you look at that painting. If you're with a friend, you stand there and chat about it and look at it and have some comments, and then you'll move on and look at another one. That's the kind of feeling I wanted in this book. So in order to do that, I wanted all the left-hand pages bare. That's the wall. You're turning a page, that's a white wall. On the right page only, you will find a poem or two. If there are three-line poems, there are two.
What is the significance? I'm sorry. What is the significance of the wall?
To give you that feeling of space, to give you the heft of space. I see the poems as an entity or a living presence, something that's alive and growing and living. And so I want that on that right page because you just sort of are walking toward that, you know, and it's just visually, it's a visual balance between the white page and the poem or two on the other side. And I know that probably doesn't come across when listening to it, but I think Carol was telling me what she did to listen to it that made it work really well for her. So she could probably explain that better later. Because I don't, when I'm reading poetry books, I use my magnifier. I have to read very, very slowly because I have to, it's blown up huge. And I read everything out loud. Like, it's like I am so visually oriented that for me to read, I have to see those words, but I have to speak them to put them into my mind or into my consciousness. I have to hear them. I have to listen very carefully and slowly to really understand what it is that I'm listening to. So that's what I do when I'm reading. Otherwise, I'm reading books, you know, on the player, of course. But for something really special like poetry or things, a small book, I will do the labor, intense labor of doing it that way so that I can be reading it out loud to me.
So you use certain sort of poetic structures in this book.
Yes.
Are all the poems based on those structures or some free verse?
There are three structures in the poems. They're predominantly haiku. And the haiku is generally three lines. And then there are tanka. Those are generally five lines. And then there are some free form. What I did when I arranged the poems is I wanted you to have 10 pages of haiku poems. That would give you 20 poems. So you have 10 pages of haiku. Then you have one page with a tanka. So I did that until I had 100 pages. And then I gave you at least 10 more pages of only tanka. And then I end the book with something really unique. And this goes back to when I was in California in 91. I was at Yosemite and I was a passenger in a car with my husband and a friend who was driving. And of course I have my journal out and I'm writing. I was not blind then. And so everywhere we go, I'm writing because that's what I always did. And so while we were at Yosemite, I was going through the alphabet and I was like A to Z. I was going through the alphabet, finding words that could express what Yosemite looked like or felt like to me. And then I arranged those into a series of six haiku poems. And so that collection, I put that at the very end of the book. So that collection would be there all together. So I spent a lot of time figuring out placement. I just was doing this like I would have put together an art show in a gallery where I was placing things and balancing things so that they would sound just, you know, the sounds would be a part of it and how the sounds were in different places.
One of the things that struck me about these poems is that there are no punctuation marks, maybe capital letters, but there's no periods or commas or dashes
or
whatever. So first of all, talk about why you chose to do that. And my sort of reaction when I saw that is that makes it a real challenge to read these things, right? Because you didn't.
Yes.
When I try to think through about how I'm going to read something,
yes.
I look at those punctuation marks as a clue. There aren't any clues here. So talk about what prompted you to make that decision?
Well, part of it is because I didn't know how it would work with like that. because in my mind, I was doing this visually. So, and I've had this conversation with Abby too, but Carol was working on it and she told me how she did it. And it really made sense. But anyway, so that's, you know, that's exactly what I did.
But you wanted to know
about lack of punctuation.
Yeah, I'm sort of curious. Okay. What prompted you to make that call?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm really, really a stickler about this. The longer I write poetry, the more I can't tolerate clutter in a poem. So to me, punctuation is clutter. And I want a clean space. I want every word to carry weight or have meaning. I don't want excess articles in there like the and a. And
as long as we know how to stop the flow without a punctuation.
Well, and what occurs to me is, I am far from a gardener, but what occurs to me about gardening is you do a lot of work to set up some structure, and the structure doesn't always work. I mean, sometimes things grow out of their beds, or the color, you know, becomes more or less.
You're right.
And yes. So it's sort of a balance between, freedom and structure.
Pulling the weeds out is how I look at it.
Yeah.
I want these poems to be just really clean and nature poems. But as far as the way I'm presenting them, that is a very typical way to present these poems. I've been studying haiku and tonka for years and years and years. And the best resource I can find for anybody who's interested in learning how to write haiku initially would be to visit the Plum Tree Tavern. That's a website by Russell Strer. And he is the person I think he wrote the preface or something to my chapbook. But anyway, on his site, he gives exact directions of what he's looking for when you send poems to him. He wants, like if you're writing a haiku or tonka, you don't have a title. You don't have a number for it. You use no capital letters and you keep it clean and you be specific. Let's say you want to write a poem about a tree and a rabbit. Well, what kind of a tree? It's European mountain ash tree. It's not a tree. It's a specific tree. If you're talking about an animal, it's a cat. It's a calico cat. It's a black cat. It's a tabby cat. You know, he wants you to be very specific. So I really, really respect that. And that's what I embrace when I'm writing these poems. There's a cleanness to it. There's a balance to it. I just want to go in there and root out when I see commas and periods and things. To me, they mess up the poem. That's just how I look at these. Yeah. Yeah.
So before we turn over to the audience, I would like to ask you to read a couple of your poems and sort of talk about them. So sure. There are four I know you chose in a prior conversation with us. So pick a couple of them and let's talk about them.
Yeah, I just pulled out a couple that kind of seemed like today's weather outside. So let me look and see here. Now that my cat's off my machine.
That's a good thing.
Yes. Let me see. Find the page.
See, Linda, your cat wants to read too.
Oh, I have 7 cats, so it's real interesting here. They all love me and they all love to be all over me. Okay. This one is a tonka. So if you can imagine, it's 5 lines and you won't see any punctuation and no capital letters. You just see the 5 lines there on a page surrounded by white space. Mid-morning rainfall. Little spurts of shifting breeze. Saturated ground, undulating, dripping grass, Western Pennsylvania mud. With a tonka, you want, it's a 5-line poem. So the key to a tonka is that third line. So you're building the story in those first two lines. And when you get to that third line, what you don't want is you're not writing a sentence. This isn't like writing an essay. Your poem should not read as a sentence. But that third line is a pivot line. So you're establishing what you're talking about in those first two lines. You come to that third line, and that's a pivot line. So my pivot line there is when I say saturated ground. I'm changing, you know, I'm telling you something a little more tangible about the day. So that is turning the poem in a slightly different direction. And I end up taking you into Western Pennsylvania mud.
So do me a favor and read that poem again.
Yes.
Now that you've provided that explanation, particularly the pivot point of that third line.
So I will.
Would you mind rereading that? That'd be terrific. Thank you.
Mid-morning rainfall. Little sprouts of shifting breeze. Saturated ground. Taking you from the breeze now to the ground. Undulating, dripping grass. It's getting a bit nasty now. Western Pennsylvania mud.
That's really fascinating. And it's fascinating how you read it too. You read it very slowly.
Yes.
And you read it as, you know, with each word, you know, sort of meaning something.
That's my goal, is that every word is carrying a part of something. It's like a moving part of a vehicle. It all has to work together, but it's taking you somewhere. You're going on a journey when you enter into the poem.
So let's read one more, and then, Bob, if you don't, we can throw it to the audience.
Yeah, because we have 20 minutes to go.
Let's
hear the second one.
Let me see what I have here now. Uh-huh.
Or if you want, we can throw it up for questions now and read later.
Either way, because maybe when there's a hand not raised, Linda can get back to it. We could just take questions.
Let's do that. I want to make sure there's time for questions.
Okay, so you're listening to In Perspective with author Linda Lambert. And let me turn it over to Trish to find out if anybody would like to ask Linda a question.
Okay, the first one we have is Leonore, L-E-O-N-O-R-E.
Leonore.
Leonore, I apologize.
Yeah, I'm Linda's editor. And so, of course, I had a lot to do with putting the book together. My husband does the formatting, beautiful formatting. And I found the layout very interesting, just the two, which she described in detail, just two, at the most, two poems per page, only on the right-hand side. There are just a few illustrations. They're beautiful photos, mainly from her garden. Her gardens, and those where they appear are on the left-hand side across from the poem that they refer to. But those are the only things that are on any of the left-hand pages, and they're only about half a dozen photos, very beautiful photos, mainly of flowers, but not entirely. And then her picture is in the back. And then most of the lines, Peter, you talked about you didn't know how many syllables there were. I was just glancing at them. Most of them are very short. They're like 4 to 6 syllables in most of the lines. And then the book itself is 172 pages total. But there's not a lot of text because each page just has these very short poems on them. So that's how it's laid out. And then the cover is very beautiful. We simply found the image on Shutterstock, the way we do with most of our cover images. And it's a close-up of a robin's nest in a tree. The foliage is very dense and very green. And then the nest is kind of gray and brownish. And then inside the nest are two beautiful, bright blue robin's eggs. Robin's eggs are kind of renowned for their beautiful bright blue colors, so they're very striking. So that, you know, the whole cover is just entirely the foliage and the nest and the eggs, and then the lettering is in white, so it shows up above the on the foliage there. So each day holds some small joy, and then her name is at the bottom. So it's very, very pretty cover.
Thank you, Leonore. And thank you for all the work you do for all of us.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you very much. You're more than welcome.
Thank you for that.
I'll second that motion.
Yeah. Trish.
Yes, who do we have next?
We have Tony.
Hello, Tony.
Hi. I want to, give a shout out to Leonore, who I'm working with right now. Linda, I have to first congratulate you. I haven't been keeping statistics, but I think you have garnered maybe double the usual amount of folks who come to one of Bob's podcasts.
I love it.
We're just going to go with that, okay?
I love it. Thank you.
Now, as a fellow writer, I have a question that's mostly based on envy, because I think I know the answer, but do the words flow from your head to your hand rather easily? They do not for me, but do they flow rather easily for you?
No, they don't. I make lists I have a list laying here on my desk. Like I really wrestle with the words, like looking for right words. Like, so let's see. This was just paper I'm working from here. So let me see what I have on here. Let's say I wanted to talk about an entity or a presence. So I began thinking of words that, you know, might not want to use those words, but I might want to use an idea. So I have here, I just started making words. I wrote down animation, existence, life, actuality, presence, or organism. So you get the idea. It's like I lay down lots of information. I begin with, you know, way more information, and then I begin weeding it out. So some things can come fast, but most things do not. Most things I really have to sift a lot to find just what I want, the feeling that I want that word to carry.
Well, thanks. I have a lot of respect for you, and it makes me feel better to know that we are all in the struggle together.
It is.
I second that motion too.
Thank you, Tony. And I agree with you, Linda. The issue of editing is for me the most challenging part of anything, you know.
Well,
shining things so that they glow,
yes,
so that they are,
yes,
radiant and they glow, or they,
yes,
have the feel that we want.
And I can't take it all the way there. I thank God every day for Leonore because she is the best editor. I'm a big picture person. I mean, I realize that about myself. I get this whole big picture, but I am not a person who can deal with all the details and getting them together right. And she will definitely verify that. Because if you see the draft when I send it to her, I take it as far as I can take it, but then I send it with apologies because that is as far as I can take it. I have to have, you know, that expertise that she has to pull things together the way she does. And she really just takes it and makes it into a work of art that I wanted.
Thank you, Tony. Who's next, Trish?
Well, we have Sally.
Sally.
Hey, Sally. Are you muted or unmuted or?
Yeah, she's still muted. Sally, can you unmute? Next, we'll go to Carol.
Carol, welcome. Sally, we'll get back to you.
Am I on mute?
Yes, I
hear you. Yes, you are.
Okay.
Well, thank goodness for that. I wanted to say that I got Linda's book because I specifically wanted to use a lady Kindle type reading to see how it flowed. And what I found is that I had to put it at 3/4 of time instead of full of, you know what I'm saying? 3/4 of instead of a.
So it's slower than the normal pace, fourth. Right? By 25%.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And I had to stop after every one or two. And the nice thing about the A-Lady is you can say repeat. And I could go in and repeat. It wasn't perfect, but it gave me the feeling that Linda was trying to do. And I can't wait to see if she can get someone to read it, because then she can have the spaces between each poem that she wants. And congratulations, Linda. It's great.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, I will have it done for Audible. Yeah.
This is one of those situations. I've run a couple of readers workshops for Behind Our Eyes. And this is one of those situations where the reading really does matter.
Yes.
You know, when I read these poems, it's not the way I envisioned them, but it makes a whole lot more sense with you reading them, the pace and all that. So
yeah.
The way you read stuff is really important. Thank you, Carol.
Go back to Sally.
Sally around?
Yeah, I believe she's unmuted now. Go ahead, Sally.
Okay. I am fortunate enough to be part of a small poetry writing group with Linda. And I found that the grace and the beauty and the warmth of her poems is simply who Linda is. And I wish her all the best with this book.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sally. I loved your comments at the beginning of the book.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for that.
It was my pleasure.
No, it's worth it. Thank you, Sally.
Thanks, Sally. Trish?
All right. We have Abby next.
All right, Abby, welcome.
Well, hello. I'm sorry. I came in late because my transit was late in getting me home. And so forgive me if you've already covered this, Linda, but I'm just wondering, you know, I've known Linda for years, and it never ceases to amaze me how, despite having lost vision later in life, she can provide such vivid descriptions, flowers, birds, trees, wildlife. And I'm just wondering, are you solely relying on your memory of how those things looked, or are you having someone describe these things to you?
No, I don't have anyone describe anything to me. I live by myself, and I'm here by myself doing everything.
Right.
Yeah, I was blessed with a very good memory, and I didn't realize how good my memory is until I did lose my sight. And that's when I realized, because then you have to do everything by memory. And, you know, but I've always was like, if I met somebody, let's say I met them one time, somebody introduced me to them, and maybe we said a few words to each other, and then maybe 5 years went by and I never saw that person again for 5 years. This happened, and somebody came to my door. I knew exactly who it was. It's like I have an extremely good memory for imagery and for people. I can identify people. I identify people by how they move in space. Now, I mean, that's how I identify people anyway, because I'm an artist. So you watch for gestures. Everything is about gestures. Everything in life is a gesture. And so that just worked perfectly with being blind, because I do have a little bit of peripheral vision, not clear at all, but just blurred vision. So I can tell how somebody's moving in space. If they're close enough, you know, I can see them move. I can see movement. I know exactly who it is by the way they move in space. But I was like that, you know, when I could see somebody the whole way across campus, you know, like student would wave to me from the whole other end of the campus. I would know exactly who the student was because I could see how they move in space.
Wow. That's really something. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, Abby, for the wonderful review.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Such a beautiful surprise this morning. It was like the first thing I saw. I was so happy.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Thanks, Abby. We appreciate it. Anybody else?
We currently have 9 minutes and 5 hands.
Wow. All right. Let's.
Pam, Coffee, you are next.
Pam Coffee. Go ahead, Pam.
Okay. I will try to make this very brief. Linda, I heard you say that at some point in life you lost your sight, and I can just imagine how that would intertwine with your faith journey, etc.
Yeah.
My question is, did you lose it suddenly, or was it a gradual thing?
Thank you, Pam. That's such a great question. I lost it almost overnight. I had something I never heard of in my life, ischemic optic neuropathy.
Good
you
grief.
Don't have any idea that anything's going to ever happen to you. Just bam, you just, I went to the gym in the morning. I would always work out in the gym before I went to work for the day, and I couldn't see. I just, and so I figured, because I work a lot and I was tired and needed rest or something. But here I, within 2 days, I had lost the sight in one eye. And then 10 months later, the other one went.
Oh, so my.
Okay, since a lot of you would know this, like when it happened, my vision was, is it, let's see, 200? Yeah, a profound sight. So it's, mm-hmm. Is that what it's called, 200? It has come up a little bit though, you know, like over the years, and they told me it's because I use these machines that really cause me extreme pain to use them. And when they put them in, they said, no matter how bad your eyes hurt, no matter how bad it is, how much it hurts, you keep using them. And so I just kept forcing myself. And then I went away to school for 4 months for rehabilitation. And that's the same thing they told me there. I would have to, like, just even to read a sentence, I had to go to bed for the day. I mean, it was that painful sometimes. Oh. But now I can work for hours on end. I just take Excedrin.
Thank you, Pam. I'm worried about
Thank
time.
You.
But that's a whole conversation we should have about all that. Who's next?
Okay, Mary Carla. Hey, go ahead.
Hi, Mary.
Carla?
You hear me?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, good, because I was having some problems. Okay. From a first of all, I want to congratulate you on the book, and I really love that poem. I can identify right now in the rain in Western Pennsylvania, but Western Pennsylvania mud. I just encountered that with Sparky a minute ago. Anyhow, from a fellow poet to another one, a question that I have is, how do you feel about, well, symbolism and poetry, and if it's universal and it's how it's interpreted, and do you think sometimes in literature classes and things we go overboard with that? Because, well, to tell you the truth, I conducted an interesting experience. I read a poem that I had written, and I asked a group in a poetry forum to tell what they thought the poem was about. And either it was a very bad poem, and I don't think it was, because they liked the poem and I thought it was good, but they didn't get it right. And I thought that if this had been in a literature book, it wasn't exactly about what I was saying. It was about, they read all kinds of symbols that weren't there. So I was being very literal, but very poetic. So I just want your feeling about this whole thing with symbolism.
Well, my feeling is, coming from the art background that I have, I create the work, the art of the poem for me is the work in the writing. And what is on that page is the residue of what was left when I was done making the art. To me, the art is the process, the making of it. And once I make it, it's no longer mine. I release it. When it's on that page, it belongs to whoever reads it and however they interpret it, because we all bring our own self into what we're looking at or what we're reading. We bring our history. We bring the things we know or don't know. Every person who comes up to it can have something different because they're bringing their own self to it. You know, it doesn't belong to me after it goes on the page. I send it off. So thank I have you. A whole different feeling about it.
No, that's a really interesting comment because, okay, anyway.
We have about 2 minutes. We really want to get through these. And then, Linda, we also need time for you to tell us where to get the book. So make sure we save time for that.
Yes.
Next.
Okay. So next we're going to go with Leonard.
Leonard, welcome.
Welcome. I have a question about, you used to do art, visual art.
I still do.
That's what I was going to ask you about. You still do visual art. How do you do it?
Every day.
How?
Yeah. Well, what I did when I first lost my sight is I always knitted. So I taught myself to knit all over again, and I would make clothing and stuff. But I'm actually in a project with Carol, and we won't talk about that too much right now, but she and I are both painting again, because instead of saying we can't do it anymore, Carol says, why not? And so every day, Carol and I are actually painting or printmaking or whatever in a year-long project that we're working on together. So I am creating a poem every day and painting every day. Yeah.
Do you just paint abstract, or can you paint something more fitting the, you know, the reality? I don't know what the words to use.
You're talking about perceptual art. I am not a perceptual artist. I am a conceptual artist. A perceptual artist wants to make something that looks like a photograph. They want to duplicate something that they see there. And a conceptual artist is looking at something from the senses and from all different directions and layers. It's much more intense. And
thank you very much, Linda. I don't think we're going to have time for anybody else, because we do want to wrap up. And Linda, if you can tell us where we can find your book, Each Day Brings Some Small Joy.
Yes, you can find it on Amazon and actually all the booksellers online. You can go to my book website at Dworkin's. So that would be dldbooks.com/Linda Lambert.
And that's Linda with a Y, right?
Yes, Linda, L-Y.
Yeah, it's important that we note that. Your name has yes. a Y in it. Most people
that's
name
right.
Linda have an I, but not you.
No.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to close up. It's time to say goodbye. Linda, thanks, and good luck. And
thank you. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Linda.
Keep up the good work. And I want to thank everybody else as well. Thank you for participating on today's program. Next week, we have a congressman friend back, John LeBoutelier. That should be a lot of informative talk about politics and government. Take care. Go safe with God's abundant blessings. I'm Bob Branco. He's Peter Alchil. Have a great day.